with your host, Alex Smith.
You know, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere causes global warming. But methane and nitrous oxide are more powerful warming gases. They are increasing as methane pours out from gas fracking, leaky pipelines, and industry. Natural methane production by tropical bogs and thawing permafrost add even more, as Earth heats up. But it's a short-lived gas, right? Maybe not.
Humans change the atmosphere, a part of Earth that's pretty hard to study. Atmospheric scientists specialize in this research, and among the leaders is Dr. Michael J. Prather. With a long history of publications, Michael is Distinguished Professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. Prather and co-author Li Zhu just found the dangerous warming gas methane can last longer in the atmosphere than we thought. Models and climate expectations may need to be changed. From Irvine, California, Michael Prather, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Glad to join you.
So we have a carbon tracker, and people pay a lot of attention to carbon dioxide, but methane is not really a climate celebrity. How much does methane in the atmosphere drive the extreme warming that we've experienced in recent decades?
Well, methane has always been the number two greenhouse gas. Of course, being the number two child, you always get left behind on things. But basically, methane by itself is about a third as much as CO2, but it also changes ozone and water vapor in the stratosphere, which adds about another third. So the methane impact for the concentration we're looking at now is about 60% that of the CO2 increase.
That's pretty big. So according to the World Meteorological Organization, methane, or CH4, has a relatively short lifespan in the atmosphere, lasting, 8 to 10 years. Robert Howarth of Cornell warned methane lasts much longer. Would you care to weigh in?
Methane, we sort of know what happens to it in the atmosphere because we know the reactions. The loss rate of methane is highly variable, and we've done a lot of studies, both aircraft and other studies and modeling studies, to try to understand the variability of methane and its loss. Generally, I would say we have a number that sits between 8 and 12 years. It's hard to imagine living much longer. Now, that's an estimate of the E-fold time, sort of the decay rate, which would be a standard exponential decay, which would be 1 over 2.8 every 8 to 12 years. So it's not a half-life, but it's an E-fold time. And that's pretty well known. We have various ways of calibrating it, but there's an uncertainty range of, as you see, about 50% in that, 30-50%, that we are not sure of. And that makes a difference when you're trying to plan ahead or trying to understand if you can reduce methane by a certain amount, how much impact that will have.
Well, we just lost your co-author, Dr. Zhu, in Albany, but I want to ask, why did you and she undertake this new study?
All right, so Lin Zhu and I met several times at the HU in scientific meetings, and she works a lot on laboratory measurements and was doing an extremely difficult measurement, which was the ultraviolet absorption of water vapor and the ultraviolet that reaches the surface of the Earth. And so she had gone through very hard-knocked life of pushing the instrument to the limit and trying to measure the absorption. People before had measured it and found it to be insignificant, and she found that it was significant at some level, and she could detect it. And so we used to talk at the meetings, and so I got interested, so I took her results and put them into a model that we have in UCI, and that would allow the water vapor to absorb and change the basically the radiation field in the lower atmosphere. And we found it reduced the ultraviolet by about 10% near the surface where most of the methane is lost in the lower atmosphere. And therefore, it ended up changing the lifetime methane about 4 or 5%, which meant that we reduced it, which means methane was then longer lived by that amount. And so it's still, this is all within the uncertainties we have, but it's a systematic offset. So you're looking at a scientific thing, which we trust those measurements, then we have a significant offset in the lifetime. And now we're looking at, again, 5% or so shift in how we model the lifetime and the loss of methane.
Well, 5% of something that is so widespread in the atmosphere is a significant amount. Now, Could you please introduce us to the key player in some ways, the hydroxyl radical, and why they matter?
Okay. So normally our atmosphere is driven by photolysis of ozone in the ultraviolet. And so that's at wavelengths less than 320 nanometers. It's fairly small. You don't see, your eyeball can't see it. It's the kind of sunlight that causes erythema, basically sunburn, and also skin cancer. And so we have the ozone layer to protect us from it in the stratosphere. And what this is doing is it's adding more protection because water vapor, which is prevalent throughout the lower atmosphere, it's humidity, you know, it's basically what we feel in the steamy weather, that now absorbs in the ultraviolet in addition to ozone. So there's another gaseous, you know, species in the atmosphere that takes up the sunlight in this critical region. And this region is where the region where when you photolyze ozone, you make very highly energetic, basically stable atomic atoms, O single D, semi-stable, that reacts with water vapor. So water vapor and the ozone photolysis product drive the hydroxyl radical. And hydroxyl radical cleans up methane as well as many other pollutants. So we've not only made methane live longer, but we've also reduced the ability to clean up other pollution in the atmosphere.
Okay. And also, we know the warmer atmosphere will hold more water. Could a wetter atmosphere further increase the lifetime of methane, or does that matter?
It will. The question is how much. We know that water vapor increases about 7% per degree. And so if we say that we're going to be warming 4 degrees Celsius, which is a lot, which would be really bad for climate, we get about a 30% increase in this effect. And so it would enhance the problem, and it would, say, drive it from, say, 5% to 6%. Or 4%, 5%. So a warmer, wetter atmosphere, which we expect in future climates, will enhance this effect, but it will enhance it at a level that is, you know, worrisome and important, but not stunning. It's not going to double it. It would increase it by maybe 10 to 30%.
Now, in the 1800s, Irish physicist John Tyndall captured air in glass flasks and discovered carbon dioxide warms the atmosphere. How did you and Dr. Zhu study methane gas chemistry in the atmosphere? What are your tools?
Okay, so my tools are basically a photochemistry model that I built in various pieces. It includes putting together all the physics we know of the trace gases, their laboratory measurements, atmospheric measurements of how much ozone is out there in the first place and how the sunlight goes through it, measurements of the solar spectrum from space and from balloons. And so we put together those into a physics model. And Dr. Lei Zhu was the one who had the laboratory instrument. So she worked very hard to measure, to put water vapor in a test cell and try to measure the absorption. And that's a really tough measurement because it's a very, very low cross-section, but there's so much water vapor in the atmosphere compared to any other species. I mean, water vapor in our atmosphere, the reason why it's important, is like oxygen. Oxygen's 21%. Water vapor in the lower atmosphere is 1% to 2%. Okay, so it's one of the major species. And so even with very, very, very small cross-sections, it has quite a large effect.
In our email exchange, I asked how much extra warming is implied by your new understanding of methane in the atmosphere, and your answer surprised me, none. And I read your 2012 paper, Reactive Greenhouse Gas Scenarios. I admit, I still don't get it. If methane lasts longer than previous models showed, why doesn't that add more warming?
Okay. It does sound nonsense, doesn't it? The funny part is that what we use to calculate how long methane lasts in the atmosphere is basically a calibration against measurements of other trace gases that we know about. And we use the models to figure out how that might change with climate and with other gas emissions. But we don't take the current absolute value from the models and use it. Why? Because we think it's always been too fast removal. So the actual numbers that IPCC uses to estimate impact of methane on future atmospheres is actually calibrated against other observations of trace gases that we scale to get the lifetime of methane. So what the new work did was show that the models, which always had methane being lost too quickly, can now approach the observations that had other trace gases that indicated that methane was actually being lost more slowly. And so they never really trusted the models I mean, that's where I live by building models, trying to understand them. But effectively, we agreed that the best way to understand methane was to scale it to other trace gases.
So you'd already sort of adjusted for this possibility.
Well, what we have, what the still work does, the reason why it was of interest to science forever, is that the models had always had methane being destroyed too quickly. And we said, no, we think the scaling to other trace gases is more accurate. So we've used that in IPCC assessments since 1990. So what this does is it says, oh, maybe the models are not as far off as we thought they were. So it pushes the models closer to the answer we get from scaling.
I get it. Now, is it fair to say that humans didn't just change the atmosphere? Have we destabilized it?
Ooh. When we were first looking at methane and chemical feedback, because methane has a feedback on its own lifetime, we were looking at instability and whether or not we put enough junk in the atmosphere, it would lose the ability to clean itself. So there was this issue about runaway methane growth in the 1990s. And when you build simple models, you can always get conditions under which it has the runaway growth. But as we built more and more sophisticated or more detailed models, not just sophistry, more detailed models, more chemistry, we found out that we were nowhere near a methane runaway growth that was originally proposed in the 1990s. Because there's enough degree of freedom, there's enough activity going on in the atmosphere that increasing methane will add to the enhancement of methane, but we're far away from an instability in the chemistry.
You worked with NASA on aircraft exploration of atmospheric processes. What is the state of play for that program, and what do you hope it achieves?
Well, the program that I worked with, I've worked on many NASA aircraft programs in various ways. When I was at NASA, I worked on designing them. As a university professor, I worked on using them to understand the models. And recently, I helped design one that did a lot of surveying to go after the methane lifetime and the methane loss in the atmosphere in high detail, and looking at sort of like bits and pieces, parcel by parcel, the variability throughout the atmosphere. That one came up with some pretty good stuff, and we now begin to understand the variability and where methane is lost, and we have good tests now for the models. That effort ended in 2019. It was called the Atmospheric Tomography Mission, ATOM. And right now it's open to be reproposed, but NASA... It's just two good news and bad news. NASA finally had to shut down the DC-8 aircraft, which enabled it. It was a huge old DC-8 filled with instruments and people flying up and down the Atlantic and Pacific. But NASA has just acquired and is now rebuilding, take another year or two before it can fly, a 777 aircraft, which will have twice the capacity and twice the distance of the DC-8. And so it opened up another opportunity, shall we say, for measuring the remote atmosphere and sampling it. The advantage of the aircraft is you fly through it and you measure every air parcel, you measure the full composition, you know, every few seconds. And this gives you a sort of a sample that's only, it's about maybe 100 meters long by 10 meters thick. So you're measuring those sort of the individual air parcels. And so then you can add up all the statistics. And it gives you a view of the complexity of the atmosphere, the extremely reactive parcels, the sort of parcels that aren't doing anything. And it allows you to sum over a wide range. For example, the methane loss in the parcels we measured varies from effectively several parts per million per day to, in some parcels, to almost nothing, like 0.01. And so some parts of the atmosphere are really reactive, and they're really important to understand, and other parts, it really doesn't matter what you do there. So it's an interesting task of sort of going through the heterogeneity of the atmosphere with the aircraft, which has been quite instructive.
And I wouldn't have imagined it that way. I thought it was all sort of evenly spread out among the gases, but you're saying there's sort of pockets and regions of it?
Well, methane is mostly spread out, except air emissions, but the reactivity that destroys it is quite heterogeneous. It's got hot pockets, it's got cold pockets. Thus, if you look at methane, because it has a lifetime of about 10 years, it's pretty well mixed. It'll be variable at maybe 5%. You'll see variations at 5%, 8%, 10% around the globe. But the loss of methane, you'll see variations of a factor of 100 between some parts of the atmosphere which are not doing anything and other parts which are highly reactive. And that's because of all the small, highly reactive trace gases that have sources and sinks. For example, nitrogen oxides made from lightning over the globe were highly important, but they are very localized, and they last for a while, and sort of you have intense regions of chemical reactivity.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I think science is progressing, and we keep learning more and more. Some of the things we learn make us worry because it means we may not understand what's really going on. But most of the time, we tend to improve it, like this water vapor absorption that Lei Zhu and I found from working at Health in Albany. This stuff is sort of like one last thing sitting out there that we may have forgotten. And so it's like tightening things up and getting more and more confident in your projections. So I would say in terms of understanding methane and this and other projects that people are working on, they're quite amazing, especially on emission patterns and location of the natural sources, are really very important to understanding this important greenhouse gas.
From the University of California, Irvine, we've been speaking with distinguished professor Michael J. Prather. His work has been fundamental to understanding the atmosphere, and he's also been a leader in organizing science to study it. Find links to find out more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Michael, thank you for taking the time to talk with our listeners.
Alex, so glad to join you this afternoon. Thanks a lot.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
For years, governments and experts told us forests are like sponges soaking up our carbon waste. Even if you log them, the new green growth will suck up more carbon. But more honest reporting reveals logging leaking more greenhouse gases than they recapture. Canada has about 9% of all forests, third biggest behind Russia and Brazil. The Canadian government pushed that myth of forest sinks and neutral logging for decades. They recently came more clean, but of course not really clean. Our future climate could hang in the balance. This is big stuff. According to a new report released September 2024, logging emerges as Canada's third largest climate polluter. Lead author is Dr. Michael Polanyi, Policy and Campaign Manager for the Nature-Based Climate Solutions at Nature Canada, which is a nonprofit conservation group. From Ottawa, Canada, Michael Polanyi, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Good to be with you.
Before this year, what was the government of Canada telling the world about greenhouse gas emissions from their giant logging industry?
Nature Canada has been talking with officials from Environment Canada and Natural Resources Canada, raising concern that they aren't transparently and separately reporting greenhouse gas emissions from logging in Canada. If one looks at the government's emission reduction plan, you see pretty clearly what the emissions are for most economic sectors, whether it's agriculture or oil and gas or transportation, but it's impossible in that document to know what are the greenhouse gas emissions that Canada's large logging industry is responsible for. So really, the problem is that Canada is not separately and transparently telling Canadians what the greenhouse gas emissions are associated with logging, and that makes it very difficult to put in place policies to address the emissions from that sector.
About 46,000 Canadians work in logging. Many of my neighbors do. Before these new admissions, was the government just sort of hiding this, or did new science reveal this increase in emissions because of logging?
Well, what the Canadian government reports is what they call combined net flux from forest land, including harvested wood products. And that's a bit of a mouthful. What they're talking about there is they report the net carbon emissions from all of forested land that's in the managed forest. And that number is roughly carbon neutral. And the problem with reporting that is the government is crediting the logging industry with a massive carbon sink that the industry really has done nothing to create. So this is a carbon sink that's created by trees regrowing naturally after wildfires. And even though Canada does not count the emissions from wildfires because they deem those to be natural, they do take credit for in 2022 about 130 megatons of carbon sequestration that occurs after wildfires by trees that are naturally regrowing. So this is a bit complicated, but the bottom line is that Canada is really masking the true carbon footprint of logging by basically giving the logging sector credit for work that's being done by Mother Nature.
Well, and we're sort of masking the true additions of greenhouse gases by Canada when we report to world bodies and to the rest of the world.
Well, exactly. I mean, our study found that logging emissions in 2022 were 147 megatons, and that makes logging the third highest emitting sector in the Canadian economy after oil and gas and transportation. And that 147 megatons is about 20% of Canada's total reported emissions. So the problem is that Canada has an emission reduction plan, which is ignoring one-fifth of the emissions from its economy. And it's putting in place policies that are based on a kind of false picture of industrial logging as being carbon neutral. So often in policymaking at the federal and provincial level, forestry is portrayed as a low carbon sector, a sector that is a potential carbon or climate solution, when in fact it's one of the biggest emitting sectors in the Canadian economy.
So let's break this down. A whole valley or mountain of trees is cut down. Where does the new carbon into the atmosphere come from?
What we did in our report was we used a methodology that was developed by a climate researcher called Matthew Bramley. He passed away, unfortunately, but other academics have drawn on his work, and university faculty from the University of Toronto and University of New Brunswick in Fredericton published a paper in a peer-reviewed journal in January, and that's the methodology that we used. And in brief, what it involves is taking the total carbon that is removed from the forest during the logging process. So some of that carbon is from the soil that's disturbed, some of it's from wood that's actually removed from the forest, and some of it's just wood waste that decays on the forest floor. So taking that amount of carbon, and it's a massive amount of carbon, and then subtracting the amount of carbon that's sequestered, that's pulled out of the atmosphere by trees that are replanted by logging companies after they've logged forests, giving them credit for that. And then also subtracting or giving credit for carbon in wood that's stored over decades in long-lived wood products like construction materials, 2x4s, furniture, other wood products that keep the carbon out of the atmosphere for decades. So that's really how we calculated the net logging emissions in Canada.
And totally missing in too many discussions, tell us how soils exposed and disturbed by logging leak out greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
I mean, in the boreal forest is a huge store of carbon. Canada's boreal forest is, as people probably know, is a massive area. It stores about twice as much carbon as all the known oil reserves in the world. And a lot of the carbon in the boreal is stored in the soil. And much of logging in Canada is conducted through clear cutting. And when there's a clear cutting that takes place of a forest, a massive amount of soil is disturbed, and that causes the carbon to be released into the atmosphere. Researchers like Dr. Suzanne Simard at the University of British Columbia have explored this and have raised concern that Canada's modeling of the impacts of forestry and logging doesn't fully take into account the carbon dynamics from soils, the carbon loss from soils. And I think researchers have indicated that, you know, even if a forest is replanted with saplings, which do grow fairly quickly and start to absorb carbon, you know, fairly quickly, it takes decades, if not more than 100 years, for those regrowing saplings to balance off the massive amount of carbon that's lost during the clear cutting process.
And what about all those diesel-burning trucks and heavy equipment and people driving around and gas chainsaws? Is that a factor, or is that just a tiny amount compared to what's really going on with the trees?
Yeah, we didn't include in our calculation the carbon emissions associated with industrial equipment, with transportation of logs after they've been harvested. So that is something that we didn't include. That appears, I believe, in another section of Canada's National Inventory Report. So really, the 147 megatons that we calculated was exclusively the amount of carbon coming out of the forest minus the amount of carbon sequestration from regrowth after logging, and also subtracting the amount of carbon added to long-lived wood products.
Can the Canadian logging industry significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions, or does real climate action simply mean logging less and preserving more forests?
So I think the question is, you know, what are some ways that Canada's logging industry can reduce the emissions associated with logging? And I mean, I think what we have suggested and is also suggested in the peer-reviewed paper by David Bysouth and co-authors is, you know, thinking carefully about where we log, thinking about how we log, and thinking about what we use harvested wood for. So in brief, yes, likely there will need to be a shift in logging away from the most carbon-rich forests. So away from old growth forests and primary forests, which are forests that have never been logged before, towards secondary forests. So harvesting forests that have been replanted rather than expanding into primary forests, which store so much carbon, which is so important in terms of fighting climate change. Secondly is shifting away from clear cutting. It's not totally clear what percentage of logging is by clear cutting, but it seems like, you know, roughly 60 to 70% is. So that's based on, you know, government databases. So moving away from clear cut logging towards more selective logging, which means taking some trees out of the forest, but not clearing all trees and disturbing the soil as much as is done through clear cut logging. And then the third is just making sure that as much as possible, when we are harvesting logs, we're using those logs for long-lived products, which I talked about before. So for wood materials, construction materials, that sort of thing. Rather than using logs for wood pellets that are burnt and emit carbon immediately into the atmosphere, or short-lived products like tissue paper and toilet paper. So as much as possible, making sure that we're keeping the carbon out of the atmosphere. And that's going to help economically as well, because long-lived wood products have more value added. They're more likely to create jobs than short-lived products.
You can find the 2024 logging emissions update at the website naturecanada.ca. We've been speaking with the lead author, Dr. Michael Polanyi. Michael, thank you for your work and talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex, so much for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting. Reporting from the Climate Battle Zone, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Michael Mann on CNN.
It's pretty basic physics that tells us that the warmer you make the oceans, the more moisture they evaporate into the atmosphere, the more energy there is to intensify these storms, the more rapidly they intensify. When they're more intense, when those winds are stronger, you get a larger storm surge. They pile up more water, and when it makes its way towards the coastline, you get the sort of catastrophic flooding that we're seeing, as well as inland flooding, because, again, the air is very warm. There's more moisture in that storm. And so as it continues after it makes landfall and it progresses sort of northward in this case, it continues to dump out huge amounts of rainfall. And they're seeing, you know, quite a bit of flooding even inland in the southeastern U.S. We'll be right back.